Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the head of the World Council of Churches makes a pastoral visit to Pyongyang and holds talks with the North Korean president. Plus, chapter 17 of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries. Churches in North and South Korea can make an important contribution to the promotion of reconciliation and lasting peace on the divided peninsula. That's the view of the outgoing Secretary General of the World Council of Churches, Reverend Dr. Samuel Kobia, who visited the North Korean capital, Pyongyang, in October. The WCC delegation, headed by Reverend Kobia, visited three churches and held talks with the North Korean President, Kim Jong-nam, one of three leaders of the isolated communist nation. During the talks, Dr. Kobia discussed the urgency of resolving the nuclear weapons standoff, the need to draw up a permanent peace agreement which was never negotiated at the end of the Korean War, and the role the churches can play in promoting reconciliation with South Korea. Following his return to the WCC headquarters in Geneva, I spoke with Dr. Kobia about his impressions of the church in North Korea and his hopes for economic and political liberalization.
My visit to North Korea was a pastoral visit to the churches of North Korea. I went there at the invitation of the Korean Christian Federation, which is associated to the WCC. And I would say that the thing that struck me most was how lively the small Christian community in North Korea is, because we hear very little normally, and therefore to come to a situation where it looks so normal in a congregation like where I preached, or a house church where we listened to testimonies of so many Christians. I think that's the one thing that strikes you most when you encounter church, both the church leadership and the ordinary members of the congregations in North Korea.
These were Protestant churches, or did you see anything of Catholic churches as well?
These were Protestant churches, and especially, as I say, because our formal relationship basically is with the Korean Christian Federation, which is very much like a council of churches, but it also represents the churches at the national level. But we didn't encounter any Catholic churches or other churches, really. We had a very short visit, but we traveled quite extensively in the country.
I imagine that people belonging to these churches have to be registered members in some way. I'm wondering how close was your sense that the government or political powers are monitoring the life of these churches?
The impression I got is that there is not much of a close monitoring by the government. But obviously, there is a very close relationship between the church and the government, between the Korean Christian Federation leadership, for example. There's no doubt that the relationship between Reverend Kang Yeon-sop, who is the president of the Korean Christian Federation, is very well known at the top government leadership level. And one gets the impression that, the program that we had clearly had been worked very closely in cooperation with the government. But as Reverend Kang Yeon-sop, this president of KCF, told us, he said, look, we feel that the freedom for us to worship, to pray, to run the church is there, both in the constitution but in practice as well. So that's one gets the impression that they are quite free. Now, whether, of course, this was the case because of our visit, one wouldn't know. Where I preached Bong So Church in Pyongyang, a very interesting group was there to visit that morning, which didn't know that I was going to be there. This is Koreans from the United States. And they said that they come twice or three times a year and they worship in the church where I preached. And they mingled together with others, and again, they also said that there was quite a good amount of freedom. But then there was also a small team from the Swiss International Development Agency who knew I was going to be preaching there, and they just came to worship with us. Two of them were Roman Catholics. But they said that it was not the first time for them to worship in a church in Pyongyang. And so I think there is not too much restriction in the activities of the church ordinarily. That's the impression I came out with.
What about the possibility of carrying out any other pastoral activities outside the life of the church, if you like, the worship and the liturgy on a Sunday? Are the churches able to do anything in the way of, for example, healthcare, education in the wider society?
We didn't get to see much of that, but I raised the question in our discussions with the leadership of the Korean Christian Federation. I asked about diaconia work, you know, development, as you said, health, education, etc., because there was a reference several times by both the church leaders as well as by the president of the country whom I met, that 2012 is going to be very important year for the Democratic Republic of Korea, because that is the year that they are going to launch a huge initiative for economic prosperity. And so I asked the question, would the World Council of Churches and the ecumenical family in general be welcome to facilitate, to support, to be in solidarity with the churches in development work, including health and education and agriculture? And the answer I got to that question, I must say, was not very categorical. Yes, but they said, well, when that time comes, they would appreciate very much if WCC could organize an international platform for discussing the involvement of the churches in what they are calling the Initiative for Economic Prosperity for North Korea.
You also discussed, as you say, these economic and political issues, didn't you? And the North Korean president, I understand, told you that he favoured face-to-face talks with the United States specifically to resolve the nuclear standoff. Did you really sense a genuine desire to make progress on this question?
Yes, I must say that in discussing with Kim Jong-nam, I thought he was very genuine. The original time allocated for our discussion was half an hour, but we ended up going for, you know, more than an hour and 10 minutes. This is especially when I raised the issue of the six-party talks from which North Korea said they would withdraw. And out of that, he took quite some time to explain their position. And that's when he said clearly that before the six-party talks can resume, a face-to-face meeting between North Korea and the United States would be the top priority for them. And I think this is a matter they wanted to stress, and because I said, could we then also quote him on this when we travel or when we meet with the leaders of the six countries involved, or the other five countries rather? And he said yes. And I did mention this during our meeting in Hong Kong, immediately following our visit, where I said that I sense this genuineness and desire on the part of the leadership there to engage the United States, because he said we are still at war technically, and we must transform the agreement that, because there was no peace agreement as such, and therefore he said that we must, first of all, have a a peace agreement with the United States. So I got the impression that he was very genuine, and he also expressed the urgency of this issue.
Do you sense, therefore, that there is a greater role that the churches, the World Council of Churches, or yourself could be playing in pushing for reconciliation and for the resolution of some of these very difficult issues?
Yes, I would say that the very welcoming atmosphere that I experienced in the meeting with President Kim Jong-nam led me to believe that they actually would want to see the involvement of the church, because I said we come in the name of peace. As Christians, we have no choice but to be peacemakers, because this is what Jesus Christ asked Christians to do. And I think he got very interested in that. And I would say that the role that we could play is that of interpreting what we have heard. And I am now writing to the members of the Six Party Talks to say that our understanding as WCC is that there is a willingness on the part of North Korea to engage, but these are what they hope would happen as part of, not instead of, but as part of the process.
As you said, from North Korea, you went on to Hong Kong, where both leaders from North and South Korea were calling for clearer links between believers on the divided peninsula. Can you tell us a bit more about this proposal for a confederation, what form this would take?
Yes, you know, I would say that the meeting in Hong Kong, which was to commemorate the 25 years since WCC brought church leaders from North and South Korea for the first time in Tonzaso, Japan, and which in the subsequent years after 1984, most of the meetings took place in Glion here in Switzerland. And I think out of this, it has become very clear that the churches of North Korea and South Korea could very well inspire the reunification process if they were to be, well, it's a kind of, they call it as confederation or federation of the churches there, because what they wanted to do is to say it is possible for the churches in the North and in the South to be united, if you will. And if churches can be united on a platform where they agree how to talk to the government, to the six-party talk process, to those others who could influence this whole process, I thought that this is a very good idea, which was welcomed by churches both from North and South.
And so the next steps along this road to a proposed confederation, what will happen next?
The next thing is for the in the World Council of Churches at least to facilitate the coming together in order to now concretize the whole concept of confederation. And we said that what has been all these 25 years, a process where WCC was the one that was basically bringing them together, time has come when leadership of both countries would then take over. And therefore, the next thing basically for us as WCC is to provide the platform after which they will take the responsibility of organizing the meetings, and we would be simply witnesses, I would say, of how the process would be going. But I think this is a very important step towards uniting of churches and Christians of North, both North and South. And I think this would then be a very strong testimony to the government and to the society in general that actually it could be done. That uniting of churches, uniting of families could very easily lead to reunification of the Korean Peninsula.
You were obviously given very privileged access to the North during this visit. But how easy is it, though, for normal worshippers, believers on one side to visit the other side?
Well, you know, the church that we visited where I preached, the Bongso Church in Pyongyang, was constructed with a lot of support from the Presbyterian Church of Korea in the South. During the construction of the church and thereafter, I understand that there has been a lot of visits and exchange quite freely. Now, whether Christians are simply wanting to come to be in fellowship with and worship with their brothers and sisters on the other side would be welcome as an ongoing feature and not as specially arranged. That, I think, is yet to happen. But, and that is what we would want to do with this confederation, that it will be then seen as part of the ongoing feature of the process towards reunification and uniting, that they could be allowed to be visiting freely. Of course, as we know, families also would want to be doing the same, but at the moment, it's not as easy as it was before the current president of South Korea, I think, who has complicated the situation of what had been set forth by the process that had been started by Kim Dae-jung. So I think that we, because of the kind of confidence that we have been able to build over time as the WCC, when we push for this, and I'm going to do so, and I've made this point also in my thank you letter to the government, that it is the desire of WCC, and I believe of the ecumenical movement, the World Church, that Christians should be facilitated to have fellowships and joint worship, etc., as a part of the reunification process.
My thanks there to Reverend Dr. Samuel Kobia, the outgoing Secretary General of the World Council of Churches. And now Jill Bevilacqua is back with her weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries, looking at the people and places who made up the history of the Vatican. Episode 17 is entitled Empire and Papacy, The Conflict.
The mid-11th century marked the beginning of the most expansive period in the history of the papacy.
The short pontificate of Leo IX, from 1049 to 1054, saw the political alliance with the Normans, the worsening of relations with the Greeks, the reform of papal administrative machinery, the beginning of a consistent plan of government through legates, councils, and a greatly increased correspondence.
But the most significant fact of the period was the head-on collision between papacy and empire.
The causes of the conflict were political rather than religious. For when the reforming movement became involved in political events, a clash was inevitable.
As the centuries passed, the basilicas of Rome began to show signs of wear and tear. so that rather than adding to their decoration and splendour, the popes found themselves obliged to undertake repair and restoration work.
But apart from ordinary maintenance, the popes had to contend with the damage done to the city by wars, fires, and continuous outbreaks of violence between warring factions. The worst damage of all was caused by the attacks on Rome by Henry IV and the liberator of Pope Gregory VII, Robert Guiscard the Norman, who twice set fire to the city.
Henry made a concerted attack on St. Paul's, which almost certainly caused the collapse of the ancient porch which led to the door of the basilica. The Leonine city was destroyed by fire, and consequently St. Peter's also suffered. When the Borgo was attacked, the whole portico of St. Peter's was reduced to rubble. The Normans' fire spared only Castel Sant'Angelo, due to its solid structure, while the Lateran area, right up to the Colosseum, was burnt down.
From that day, the Lateran Gate was known as the Burnt Gate. When Urban II was elected in 1088, he was obliged to take up residence on the Tiber Island, as the Lateran was in the hands of an anti-pope. It was not until Easter Sunday of 1094 that he finally sat on the Lateran throne, which he'd bought with the money of a foreign abbot who had taken pity on the impoverished pontiff.
The personality who dominates this period is, without doubt, Pope Gregory VII, the man who's been called the Caesar of Papal Rome. He stands at the frontier between two historical epochs, a colossus of the Church.
The personality of Gregory VII showed itself immediately in his declared conviction that the primacy was the gift of Christ himself, and papal authority over kings and emperors came not from a human transference of imperial authority, but from God alone.
Gregory VII had none of those physical attributes people unconsciously expect to find in a leader. He was short in stature, unprepossessing to look at, with a weak voice and fragile frame consumed by years of fasting. But his powerful personality and absolute dedication to the cause of the Church have made the name of Gregory VII one of the landmarks of papal and church history.
Elected by popular acclaim, Gregory kept the support of his people when he became pope. For 2 years later, they confirmed their choice by defending their favourite in a dramatic incident. And out of a humiliating experience, Gregory became stronger and more beloved than ever before.
Christmas Eve, 1075. It was raining. Gregory was celebrating Mass at the crib of St. Mary Major. Suddenly, shouts were heard and the clash of armour. Into the church rushed Cencio, the bandit son of the former prefect of Rome and the Pope's declared enemy. Together with a band of soldiers, he pushed his way through the frightened congregation, entering the enclosed part of the altar near the crib where the Pope was. He seized Gregory by the hair, dragged him off the altar, and threw him to the ground. He pulled off the Pope's sacred vestments, and carrying him out of the church, set him on his horse and galloped off into the dark.
For a moment, the people were too dazed to react. Then they sounded the alarm. Soon, everywhere, the bells of the city were ringing. The military were forcing open all gates and scouring the streets with flaming torches. No sign of the Pope. The people held a council on the Capitol Hill. And then, at dawn, the news came through that Gregory was being held prisoner by Cencio in his fortified tower near the Tiber. The kidnapper had not succeeded in getting his victim out of the city.
The people swarmed in a mass to the tower, forced their way into the building, and demanded the Pope's release. Cencio had no choice but to give in. On promising the Pope that he would make a pilgrimage of repentance to the Holy Land, he and his gang were allowed to go free. Only the mercy of the Pope he had so ill-treated prevented Cencio from being lynched by the furious mob. But the people took their revenge. They burnt his house to the ground. They set Gregory on their shoulders and carried him back in triumph to St. Mary Major's. The Pope took up where he'd left off and finished the Mass.
Gregory VII opened his programme of reform by issuing a decree forbidding the lay investiture of clerics. When the Emperor Henry IV refused to accept this, Gregory wrote to him privately, asking him to come to Rome to beg pardon. But Henry made the letter public, and in 1076 he called the Diet of Worms, asking for the Pope's deposition and denouncing him as a false monk.
Gregory replied by excommunicating Henry and releasing his subjects from obedience to the Emperor.
I withdraw the government of the whole kingdom of the Germans and of Italy from Henry the King, son of Henry the Emperor, and I absolve all Christians from the bond of the oath which they have made to him or shall make, and I forbid anyone to serve him as king. And since he has scorned to show Christian obedience and has not returned to the Lord whom he has deserted, holding intercourse with the excommunicate, committing many iniquities, despising my warnings, which, as thou art my witness, I have sent to him for his salvation, separating himself from thy church and trying to divide it, on thy behalf I bind him with the bond of anathema.
The bishops deserted Henry, promising him future support only if he asked the Pope's pardon. Gregory travelled north to preside over Henry's trial, but the emperor saw he would have to submit and set off south to meet him. The Pope took refuge in the castle of Countess Matilda at Canossa, thinking Henry was going to do battle. But the emperor appeared in penitential guise, standing barefoot in the snow for 3 days, waiting for absolution. The Pope pardoned him, but Henry soon broke the conditions, and battle was joined once again.
In April 1081, Henry was at the gates of Rome with his army, but he was driven off by malaria. He tried again 2 years later, and this time launched a massive attack on the city. Fighting went on in and around St. Peter's, and as Henry gained control of that side of the Tiber, Gregory withdrew to Castle Sant'Angelo. He sent an appeal for help to the Norman Robert Guiscard. Meanwhile, Henry had himself crowned in St. Peter's by the anti-pope Guibert, who had been consecrated by excommunicated bishops. Guiscard then arrived and drove Henry out, sacking the city right and left.
When Gregory saw the destruction and desolation, he was heartbroken and asked to follow Guiscard south. In Salerno he called a new council, confirming all his previous condemnations. But he was a disappointed man and died only a year later. His last quoted words were, "I loved divine justice, I hated iniquity, so I die in exile."
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented The Vatican Centuries. She'll be back at this same time next week with episode 18. Be sure to join us then. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thank you for joining me, Philippa Hitchin, and all of us here at The English Programme. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.